from russet to an intensely dark blue that deepened into impenetrable darkness until it didn't matter if my eyes were open or closed. I dropped into a solid sleep, unbroken by the distant sounds of cars and barking dogs or the careful unlatching of the door when my grandfather came back in the middle of the night, fed himself from whatever was left in the kitchen, went into his own room, slept, and woke up and left before the sun rose. It was days before I realized he lived in the small room near the front door, the only room in the house unadorned by Abuela's crochet. Abuelo slept in a narrow metal cot with a thin mattress wrapped in white sheets. There was a small table and a chair in his room, and on the wall a picture of Jesus wearing the same exasperated expression as the statues in the Mercado, his wounded hands palm up as if he were saying, "Not again." A coconut palm frond knotted into a cross was nailed above the picture. By comparison, Abuela's room was opulent, with its double bed, thick mattress, four bedposts from which to tie the mosquito netting, pillows, and a small crocheted rug. Her dresser held a brush and comb, an altar to the Virgin and Child, a rosary, a Bible, candles, a missal, a small bottle filled with holy water, a picture of Papa Pio, the Pope, and cards on which were printed prayers to saints with names like San Francisco, Santa Ana, Santa Barbara, and San Jose. Papi had told me that Abuela didn't know how to read, and I wondered what words looked like to her. Did she recognize any of them, or were they just a pattern like crochet stitches? After the first night, she closed the doors and windows right after supper, but didn't make me go to bed. I stayed up reading the day-old newspaper Abuelo left behind or traced the flower patterns on paper napkins with a ballpoint pen. One rainy afternoon, Abuela pulled out her needlework basket. "Would you like to learn?" she asked timidly, as if she'd been working up the courage to ask. "Sí, I would." I had looked closely at the elaborate motifs of her tablecloths and doilies and had tried to draw them on lined notebook paper or on flattened grocery bags. I had sat mesmerized in the almost holy silence in which she worked as she wove the needle in and out of stitches, forming pictures with thread. She found a needle with a large hook and had me sit on the stoop, between her legs, so that she could look over my head and adjust my fingers as she helped me guide the thread in and out of the loops. She taught me how to count stitches, how to make chains that became rows, how to join rounds, when to fill in, and when to build space around stitches. After a while, I learned why the silence in which she worked seemed so magical. To crochet well, I had to focus on the work, had to count and keep track of when and where I increased or decreased stitches, and keep a picture in my head of what the finished cloth should look like, all the while estimating how much cotton thread it would take, and making sure when I ran out of one spool that the other was joined in as seamlessly as possible. Sounds dwindled into dull, distant murmurs. Backgrounds receded into a blur, and sensations waned as I slid under the hypnotic rhythm of a hook pulling up thread, the finished work growing into my palm until its very weight forced me to stretch it out on my lap and look and admire and be amazed at what my hands had made. Abuelo was a quiet man who walked with his head down, as if he had lost something long ago and was still trying to find it. He had sparse white hair and eyes the color of turquoise. When he spoke, it was in a low rasp, in the Jíbaro dialect, his lips in an apologetic half-smile. His hands were rough, the nails yellowed and chipped, the fingertips scarred. He left the house before dawn, pushing before him a cart he had fashioned from pieces of plywood and bicycle parts. At the produce market, he stacked a pyramid of oranges on the top and kept two more sackfuls in the cabinet underneath. He spent his days at the corner of Calle San Cristobal in Old San Juan, peeling oranges with his pocket knife and scooping out a triangular hole through which tourists could suck the sweet juice. Each orange brought him 5 cents. He slipped the nickels into his right-hand pocket to jingle as he walked home at the end of the day, the pocket sagging against his thigh. Evenings, when I heard the rattle of his cart, I ran out to open the garden gate for him, and each time he searched the lower cabinet to see if he had any oranges left. There was always one in the farthest corner, and once he'd secured his cart against the side of the house, he sat on the stoop and peeled it for me in one long ribbon that curled and whirled and circled on itself, orange, white, orange. Sunday morning, before breakfast, Abuela handed me my piqué dress, washed and ironed. "We're going to Mass," she said, pulling out a small white mantilla which I was to wear during the service. "Can we have breakfast first, Abuela? I'm hungry." "No, we have to fast before church. Don't ask why. It's too complicated to explain." I dressed and combed my hair, and she helped me pin the mantilla to the top of my head. "All the way there and back," she said, "you should have nothing but good thoughts, because we're going to the house of God." I'd never been to church and had never stopped to classify my thoughts into good ones and bad ones. But when she said that, I knew what she meant, and also knew bad thoughts would be the only things on my mind all the way there and back. I tried to look as holy as possible, but the white mantilla tickled my neck and the sides of my face. I wished I didn't have to wear it, and that was a bad thought, since all the women and girls walking in front of us wore theirs without any complaints. I love my mother, my father, all my sisters and brothers, my abuela and abuelo, all my cousins, the governor of Puerto Rico, Doña Lola, my teacher. A boy went by too fast and bumped into me, so I bumped him back, and that was bad, because Jesus said we should turn the other cheek, which seemed stupid, and there went another bad thought. I counted all the squares on the sidewalk up to the steps of the church, then I counted the steps, 27. No bad thoughts. The church was cool, dark, and sweet-smelling. Abuela dipped her fingers into a bowl at the entrance and crossed herself. I dipped my fingers, and there was nothing but water. I tasted it, and she gave me a horrified look and crossed herself. She took my hand and walked me down the aisle, lined with pews. When she came to the front, she half-knelt, looking up to the altar, and crossed herself again before sliding in to take her seat. I did the same thing. We were early. Music came from somewhere behind us. When I turned around to see, Abuela leaned down and whispered, "Face forward. You should never look behind you in church." I was about to ask why, but Abuela put her fingers to her lips and shushed me as everyone stood up. I couldn't see anything except the back of the man in front of me. He wore a wrinkled brown suit that stretched into folds around his waist because he was so fat. That must have been a bad thought. The church's windows were of colored glass, each window a scene with Jesus on his cross. The two I could see without turning my head were beautiful, even though Jesus looked like he was in a lot of pain. The priest said something and everyone knelt. The altar had an enormous Jesus on his cross at the center, the disciples at his feet. Tall candles burned in steps from the rear of the altar to the front, where the priest, dressed in purple and yellow robes, moved his hands up and down and recited poetry that everyone in the church repeated after him. Two boys wearing white lace tunics helped him, and I was jealous because their job seemed very important. Envy, I knew, was a bad thought. I counted the times people stood up, knelt down, stood up. That didn't seem right. I shouldn't be in church counting things. I should feel holy, blessed. But I got an itch in the space between my little toe and the sole of my foot. I scraped my shoe against the kneeling bench on the floor. The itch got worse. We knelt again, so I leaned back and took the shoe off to scratch my foot. But I had to get up because the person next to me wanted to get through. And other people in the same pew got up and squeezed past me, kicking my shoe toward the aisle in the process. Abuela leaned down. "I'm going to take communion. You wait right here." As soon as she was gone, I slid over to the end of the pew and looked up the aisle. No shoe. I felt for it with my foot all along under the pew, but couldn't find it. It was wrong to look back in church, so it seemed that it would be worse to look down. but I didn't want Abuela to come back and find me with one shoe missing. The people who went up to the altar knelt in front of the priest so he could put something into their mouths. As soon as Abuela knelt, I dove under the pew and looked for my shoe. It was under the pew behind us, so I crawled under ours, over the kneeling bench, and stretched to get the shoe. I crawled up just as Abuela came down the aisle. I knelt piously, my hands in prayer, and stared in front of me, trying to look like I was having nothing but the very best thoughts. Abuela went into the pew in front of me, looked over, seemed confused, got out, then knelt next to me. "How foolish. I thought we were one pew up," she whispered. When everyone had come back, I realized the man with the wrinkled brown suit was two pews up, and I looked up at Jesus and his cross and prayed, "Please, Jesus, don't let her find out I moved during the service," which I knew was a bad thought. I packed my clothes and put the doily I had made for Mommy into a corner of my small bag. Abuela made fish head soup with plantain dumplings, and we ate some for lunch. "Don't take your dress off," she said. "When he comes to pick you up, Pablito might be in a hurry to get back." But Papi didn't come. Sunday stretched long and hot through siesta time. Abuela made coffee in the late afternoon, and we sat at the table with a stack of soda crackers. "He'll probably come for dinner," she said. But the blue haze of evening shrouded the street, stifled sounds, and sent everyone indoors to their secrets, and Papi didn't come. Abuela went in to say her prayers. "He must have been held up. Why don't you change into something comfortable?" I took off my white piqué dress, which was no longer clean and starched. I thought, the minute I change clothes, he's going to show up. But he didn't, and when Abuela came out from her prayers, we sat by the door, working our needles in, around, up, and out, silently making patterns with thread that might have told a story had either one of us known how to transform our feelings into shape. Instead, she worked an altar cloth she'd promised Father David, and I added red flowers to the doily I'd made for Mommy. And neither one of us said what we both knew, that Papi wasn't coming. That perhaps the person he had to see the Sunday before needed him again, and he went there, and maybe that person needed him so much that he had forgotten about us, just like he sometimes forgot about Mommy chasing after babies in Macum. We worked our crochet until it was too dark to see, until after Abuelo had brought his cart into the yard and tied it up against the fence, until he'd peeled an orange in one long ribbon, until we'd closed up the house and gone into our separate rooms and had wrapped ourselves in the white cotton sheets edged with crocheted scallops. And I thought about how many nights Mommy had left food warming on the ashes of the fogón, how often she'd sat on her rocking chair, nursing a baby, telling us to be still, that Papi would be coming any minute, but in the morning he wasn't there and hadn't been. I thought about how she washed and pressed his clothes until they were new-looking and fresh, how he didn't have to ask where anything was because nothing he ever wore stayed dirty longer than it took Mommy to scrub it against the metal ripples of the washboard to let it dry in the sun so that it smelled like air. I wondered if Mommy felt the way I was feeling at this moment on those nights when she slept on their bed alone, the springs creaking as she wrestled with some nightmare, or whether the soft moans I heard coming from their side of the room were stifled sobs, like the ones that now pressed against my throat so that I had to bury my face in the pillow and cry until my head hurt. Every night, right after dinner, Abuela slipped into her room, put on a faded green nightgown embroidered with small yellow flowers, and undid her hair. Two twisted ropes of hair fell past her knees, one over each shoulder. She combed first one side, then the other, loosening the ropes into strands of white, gray, and a few black hairs, her fingers weaving in and out of them until each side looked like a serene waterfall against a pale forest. "Our Father, who art in heaven," I repeated after Abuela. "Hallowed be thy name." What does that mean? She raked her fingers through her hair, fluffing it, untangling the knots. It means his name is holy. Hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Abuela fed me the prayer in short phrases that echoed the rhythm I'd heard when Papi led novenas and when she clicked her beads at night before bed. It was like learning a song. If I left something out, the rhythm didn't work. Give us this day our daily bread. I imagined a long loaf of pan de agua, the kind the baker made with a coconut frond down the center of its crunchy crust. And forgive us our trespasses. What does that mean? We're asking God to forgive any sins we might commit by mistakes. Forgive us our trespasses. And lead us not into temptation. She didn't wait for me to ask. That means we're asking God to keep us from sinning. When I'd repeated the prayer several times and could recite most of it without stumbling, she taught me how to cross myself. Cross your thumb over your pointing finger like this. No, not with that hand. You must always use your right hand, she said, holding it out to make sure I knew the difference. Why? Because the left hand is the hand of the devil. I wondered if that meant the devil had two left hands, but didn't dare ask because just saying the word devil made Abuela drop her voice into a near whisper as if the devil were in the next room. Then you go straight down to your heart, then across, no, this side first. I'd seen women cross themselves so many times, it had never occurred to me there was a right way and a wrong way to do it. Then you kiss the cross on your fingers. I did as she showed me. You must always cross yourself before and after saying the Lord's Prayer. Let me see if you can say the whole thing. I tried to look grave, eyes down, face expressionless, the way people in velorios looked when Papi led them in prayer. I lowered my voice to a near mumble, quieted my lips until they barely moved, and let the rhythm guide the words out and up to the sky, where Abuela said Papa Dios, my other father, lived. Hola, Negrita. Mami wore a printed dress she called a mumu, which stretched across her pregnant belly like a round plot of exotic flowers. I couldn't get enough of her to hug, so I clung to her hand as she huffed up the three steps into Abuela's house. How are you, Doña Margara? She asked cheerily, as if she knew the answer. Oh, I'm fine, mija, just fine, Abuela said, pulling out a chair for Mami to sit in. How about some lemonade? Wonderful. Mami's cheeks were flushed, partly from the hot walk down the street, partly because she'd colored them. Her hair was twisted up and held with pins that she kept pushing in so they wouldn't fall out. I hope you don't mind that I came to bring Negi home. I've missed her. Now that she was sitting, I could hug her around the neck, kiss her soft powdered face, smell the fruity perfume she put on for special occasions. I miss you too, Mommy, I whispered, and she pulled me close and kissed the top of my head. Abuela brought in a pitcher of lemonade and three glasses. I thought Pablito was coming on Sunday. We waited all afternoon. Mami's face flashed into the hard expression I'd come to expect when she talked about Papi. You know how he is, she said to his mother. Abuela nodded and poured us lemonade. Who's watching the children? My neighbor's daughter. Who? I asked. Mami turned to me as if she just remembered who I was. Gloria, she sipped her drink. Guess what? We have electricity. Really? Yes, we only use the quinqués if the lights go out. She turned to Abuela, which is every time the wind blows hard. They laughed. I leaned against Mami and sipped my drink, listening to them talk about people whose names were familiar, but whom I hadn't met. Flor, Concha, Chia, Candida, Lalo. They talked about whose daughter had run off with whose son, who'd had babies, who had died, the price of groceries, the hot weather, the rickety buses between San Juan and Santurce. They talked as if they were good friends, and I wondered how that could be since they seldom saw each other. They came back to the subject of Macung, how things seemed to be better now that we had electricity and running water was weeks away. Of course, Mami said, with Pablo gone all the time, it's hard to know. Her face darkened again. She looked down at the floor, rubbed circles on her belly. The silence around her was total, not rich and full like abuela's when she crocheted, but empty and sad and lonesome. Negi, abuela said, go take a shower and get ready so that your mother doesn't have to wait for you. I didn't want to leave Mami, but abuela's eyes were stern, and with her head, she signaled in the direction of the bathroom. I set my glass down and went. Although I leaned against the bathroom door, trying to hear what they said, I only caught snatches. Always been that way. Upsets the kids. Think of yourself. Alone with children. Make it work. Don't know how. And in a louder voice, Negi, why don't we hear water running? I opened the faucet and let cool water wash over me, wishing it could melt away the fear that made the thumps of my heart louder than usual. When I came out, my hair dripping, the tips of my fingers wrinkled, Mami and Abuela still sat across from each other. Abuela's face was sad, and she looked older, as if years rather than minutes had passed since I last saw her. Mami's rouge was streaked, and her eyes were swollen. She pretended to smile, and I pretended not to see it as I went by wrapped in a towel, stepping lightly as if the floor would break under my weight. I dressed to their murmurs in the other room, their voices soft but strained, and I wondered if men ever talked like this, if their sorrows ever spilled into these secret cadences. I combed my hair, put on my socks, buckled my leather shoes, and still they talked, and I couldn't understand a word they said. But their pain bounced off the walls and crawled under my skin, where it settled like prickly bristles. It seemed to me then that remaining Jamona could not possibly hurt this much, that a woman alone, even if ugly, could not suffer as much as my beautiful mother did. I hated Papi. I sat on the bed in his mother's house and wished he'd die, but as soon as the thought flashed, I slapped my face for thinking such a thing. I packed my bag and stepped into the room where Mami and Abuela sat. When they looked up at me, it seemed as if we were all thinking the same thing. I would just as soon remain Jamona than shed that many tears over a man. Mami gets a job. Con el agua al cuello y la marea subiendo. With water to the chin and the tide rising. The sky fell to the tops of the mountains. The air hung heavy, moist. Birds left the barrio, and insects disappeared into hidden cracks and crevices, taking their songs. A cowboy rounded up the cattle in Lalao's finca, and on her side of the fence, Doña Ana led her cow to the shack behind her house. The radio said Hurricane Santa Clara was the biggest threat to Puerto Rico since San Felipe had destroyed the island in 1918. Papi, why do they name hurricanes after saints? I asked as I helped him carry a sheet of plywood he was going to nail against the windows of our house. I don't know, he answered. The hurricane warning must have been serious if Papi couldn't stop to talk about it. Mami bundled our clothes, pushed her rocking chair, the table and stools, her sewing machine, and the pots and pans into a corner, tied everything to the socles, pressed it all against the strongest wall of the house, and covered it with a sheet as if that would keep everything from being blown away. Negi, take the kids to Doña Ana's. We'll be there in a while. I rounded up Delsa, Norma, Hector, Alicia, and Edna. For once, I didn't have to chase them all over the place, didn't have to threaten, yell, or pull their ears for ignoring me. They lined up solemn as soldiers, Alicia and Hector hanging onto Norma's hand, Edna on Delsa's hip. The baby was asleep in his hanging cradle, but Mami took him out, bundled him in flannel sheets, and handed him to me. Take Raymond, make sure no drafts get to him. The baby was 30 days old, and we had to be careful about infections, foul breezes, and the evil eye. Mami had strung a nugget of coral and an onyx bead on a safety pin and attached it to Raymond's baby shirt at birth. It was the same charm she had used on all of us, kept in a little box among her thimbles and needles between babies, to be brought out and pinned to the tiny cotton shirts, supposedly for the first 40 days and 40 nights of our lives. She claimed she didn't believe any of that stuff, but each time, the charm stayed on long after it was supposed to. We trudged single file along the path connecting our yard with Doña Ana's. Her sons had nailed plywood sheets to the windows and along the front of her house so that the only way in was the back door leading to the latrine, barn, and pigsty. These structures had also been reinforced with plywood and debarked tree limbs buttressed every wall. As we passed from the barn, we heard the muffled and frightened moo of the cow, the frantic squealing of pigs, and the rustle and cackle of hens and roosters. Inside the house, every crack and chink had been plugged with rags to keep the wind out. Mattresses were stacked, bunches of green bananas hung from the rafters. The gash where the machete had cut dripped white sticky ooze onto the floor. The room was shadowy, lit with quinques and fat candles, steamy with the fragrance of garlic and onions. Several old hens had been sacrificed, and everyone contributed something to the communal meal that would be cooked on our kerosene stove, spiced with Doña Lola's fresh oregano, and shared by the four families who would pass the hurricane in Doña Ana's one-room cement house. Papi and Mami brought in bundles of food, clothes, blankets, and baby diapers. Papi put his battery-operated radio on a shelf and kept it tuned the whole time the hurricane blew, even though all we heard was static. Although Doña Ana's house was no bigger than ours, its sturdy concrete walls and roof made it safe and cozy. The warmth of the 30 or so people inside, the familiar aroma of spices and good cooking, and the hushed play of children was extraordinarily comforting, the way wakes were, or weddings, or baptisms. The men set up a domino table and took turns playing, the losers giving up their chairs to the ones waiting their turn. The women cut up chickens, peeled plantains, cubed potatoes, made sofrito, washed dishes, brewed coffee, and tended babies. The muchachas huddled in a giggly group between the plantains and the mattresses, while the muchachos crouched against the wall opposite, pretending to play cards. We kids played among ourselves or circulated among the various groups, observing the domino game, snatching boiled chicken hearts or livers, carrying mysterious messages from the older boys to the older girls. Every so often, a thump quieted everyone, and arguments erupted about which tree had fallen in which direction. The cows and pigs couldn't be heard above the roar of the wind, the thunder, the crashing zinc sheets from less sturdy roofs, and the flying outhouses lifted in one piece by the wind and swept from one end of the barrio to the other. After we had our asopao with plantain dumplings, we curled against one another on the mattresses and slept, lulled by the crackling radio inside and the steady gusts of the hurricane outside. We heard the ominous quiet of the hurricane's eye as it passed over us. Papi and Dima, Doña Ana's son, pried the door open a crack. It was raining lightly, gray misty drops like steam. The men stepped outside one at a time, looked around, up to the sky, down to the soaked ground that turned into muddy pools wherever their feet had sunk. The women clustered at the door, forming a wall through which we children couldn't pass, although we managed to catch a glimpse by pressing against their hips and thighs, crouching under their skirts, between their legs, against their round calves striated with varicose veins and dark, curly hair. Mist hung over the yard littered with branches, odd pieces of lumber, a tin washtub that seemed to have been crushed by a giant, and the carcass of a cow with a rope around her neck still tied to a post. Doña Ana's barn still stood, and the animals inside whimpered softly as if their normal voices would make the wind start up again. The men walked the edges of the yard in a semicircle, their hands outstretched like the stiff figures I like to cut from folded newspapers. A sliver of sun broke through like a spotlight and traveled slowly across the yard, forming a giant rainbow. The women pointed and held up the smaller children to see, while those of us big enough to stand by ourselves crowded the door in awe of that magic spectacle. The figures of our fathers and brothers moving cautiously in a world with no edges, no end, and that bright slice of sun traveling across it, not once touching them. "We had 11 avocado trees and 9 mango trees," Mommy was saying. "Now there's only the 2 avocados and 3 mangoes left." "My entire coffee patch washed right off the hill," Doña Lola spit into the yard. "And you can see what it did to my medicinal herbs. Even the weeds are gone." Doña Lola's house, nestled at the side of the mountain, had been spared, but the adjoining kitchen had disappeared, except for the 3 stones of her fogón. Our outside kitchen, too, had flown away, as had our latrine. The whole barrio had been stripped of anything too flimsy, too old, or too weak to withstand the winds and rain that had pelted the island for hours, flooding towns and washing downhill entire communities built along the craggy slopes. No one in Macun died, but many lost their belongings— poultry, pigs, milk cows, vegetable gardens, kiosks for selling fried codfish fritters, and shops where rusty old cars received one more chance at the road. Pablo said the government will help rebuild. "Sí, cuando las gallinas meen," Doña Lola laughed, and Mami chuckled, her eyes twinkling at me to see if I understood what Doña Lola meant by "when hens learn to pee." I'd been around enough hens to know they never would. Papi and Uncle Candido repaired our house, replaced parts of the roof, extended the house to incorporate a kitchen and a site for a bathroom, anticipating the day when water would be piped down the hill to our end of the barrio. They rebuilt the latrine with shiny zinc walls and added a new, more comfortable seat. Mami propped up her pigeon pea and annatto bushes, which had been flattened by the storm, and soon they bloomed again, their leaves as new and fresh as babies. For months after the hurricane, all people talked about was money. Money for the cement and cinder blocks that rose out of the ground in solid gray walls and flat square roofs. Money for another cow, or a car, or zinc for the new outhouse. Money to install water pipes or to repair the electric wires that had gone down in the storm and hung like limp, useless, dried-up worms. Even children talked about money. We scoured the side of the road for discarded bottles to exchange for pennies when the glass man came around. Boys no older than I nailed together boxes out of wood scraps, painted them in bright colors, and set off for San Juan or Rio Piedras, where men paid 10 cents for a shoeshine. Papi made Mavi bark beer and took 2 gallons with him to the construction sites where he worked, to sell by the cup to his friends and passers-by. Even Doña Lola, who seemed as self-sufficient as anyone could be in Macun, cooked huge vats of rice and beans to sell in the refillable aluminum canisters called fiambreras that men took to work when their jobs were not near places to eat. Mami talked about sewing school uniforms and actually made a few, but she soon realized that the amount of work she put into them was more than she was paid for and abandoned the idea while she thought of something else. "Negi, help me over here." Mami stood in the middle of the room, her dress bunched on her hips, hands holding fast a long line brassiere that didn't want to contain her. "See if you can catch the hooks into the eyes, all the way up." The cotton brassiere stretched down to her hip bones, where it met the girdle into which she had already squeezed. There were 3 columns of eyes for the hooks, spaced evenly from top to bottom. Even when I tugged on both ends of the fabric, I had trouble getting one hook into an outermost eye. "It's too small. I can't get them to meet. I'll hold my breath." She took in air, blew it out, and stretched her spine up. I worked fast, hooking her up all the way before she had to breathe again in big, hungry gulps. "Wow, it's been a while since I wore this thing," she said, pulling her dress up. "Zip me up." "Where are you going?" "There's a new factory opening in Tua Baja. Maybe they need people who can sew." "Who's going to take care of us?" "Gloria will be here in a little while. You can help her with the kids. I've already made dinner. Will you work every day? If they hire me. So you won't be around all the time? We need the money, Neggy. Mammy twisted and sprayed her hair, powdered her face, patted rouge on already pink cheeks, and spread lipstick over already red lips. Her feet, which were usually bare, looked unnatural in high heels. Her waist was so pinched in, it seemed as if part of her body were missing. Her powdered and painted features were not readable. The lines she'd drawn on her eyebrows and around her eyes and the colors that enhanced what always seemed perfect were a violation of the face that sometimes laughed and sometimes cried and often contorted with rage. I wanted to find a rag and wipe that stuff off her face, the way she wiped off the dirt and grime that collected on mine. She turned to me with a large red smile. What do you think? I was ashamed to look, afraid to speak what I saw. Well? She put her hands on her hips, that familiar gesture of exasperation that always made her seem larger, and I saw the unnatural diamond shape formed by her elbows and narrowed waist. I couldn't help the tears that broke my face into a million bits, which made her kneel and hold me. I wrapped my arms around her, but what I felt was not Mammy, but the harsh bones of her undergarments. I buried my face in the soft space between her neck and shoulder and sought there the fragrance of oregano and rosemary, but all I could come up with was cashmere bouquet and the faint flowery dust of Maybelline. She woke early, sometimes even before Papi, cooked the beans and rice for our supper, ironed our school uniforms and her work clothes, and bathed, powdered, and stuffed herself into her tortuous undergarments. In whispers, she gave me instructions for the day, told me when she'd be back, warned me to help Gloria with the children, promised to sew the buttons on Hector's shirt when she came home that night. Papi was not around as much once Mommy began work. And our mornings took on a rhythm that left him out the days he was home, each one of us engaged in our own morning rituals of waking, dressing, eating breakfast, and walking the 2 miles to school. My classes began the earliest, at 7:30, and I left home while the air was still sweet and the ground moist, our neighbors' houses looming like ghosts in light fog or receding behind grayness when it rained. My Uncle Candido's house was halfway to school. He complained to Mommy that I never looked up when I went by, never greeted anyone, never looked anywhere but down at the ground. If you keep walking like that, he said, you'll develop a hunchback. But that threat wasn't enough to keep me from wrapping my arms around myself. Books pressed against my chest, I strode head down, looking closely at the way the ground swelled and dipped, listening to the crunch of my hard school shoes on the pebbled stretches and their swish on the sandy patches. And when I didn't look at the ground, I was blind and would sometimes get to school and not know how. On those mornings, my eyes closed in on me and showed me pictures inside my head, while my legs moved on their own up the hills, down the ruts, through the weeds, across gullies, between the aisles of my schoolmates' desks and to my own, alphabetically in the rear of the classroom. I'd sit down, open my notebook, write the date at the top of the page, and look up to Miss Jimenez and her cheery Buenos Dias, clase. I would then realize I'd come all the way to school with no memory of the journey, my mind a blank slate on which I would write that day's lessons. With Mammy at work, I took advantage of Gloria's vigilance with the younger kids to make my own getaway into the montes, up trees, behind sheds and outhouses, and once, on a dare, into Lalao's finca, where I filled the skirt of my dress with the coveted grapefruits. "Where did these come from?" Mammy asked when she came home from work. "I found them," I said. "No, she didn't. She sneaked into Lalao's finca with Tato and Pepito," Delsa smirked, and Mammy's eyes disappeared behind a frown. "Haven't I told you not to go in there?" "They were on the ground, just on the other side of the fence." She looked at the grapefruits, green speckled with yellow and tiny black dots. Their citrus fragrance filled the room like smoke. "Don't go in there again," she said, picking one up, "or I'll really let you have it." She peeled one in long strips and sucked on the sweet juice hungrily. I sought Delsa's eyes and saw fear, not of Mammy, but of me, because Delsa knew that while Mammy was at work the next day, I'd get her for tattling. One morning, Mammy cooked our dinner, left everything ready for Gloria, dressed, and got us off to school one at a time. When I came home, she was still there, her work clothes stretched on the bed, rumpled and forgotten. "Where's Gloria?" I asked. "She escaped," Mammy said, which meant that Gloria had eloped. No girl ever ran away by herself, although boys disappeared for weeks the minute they thought of themselves as men. "Is she coming back?" "I don't know. No one knows the man she ran off with." Mammy couldn't go to work for a couple of weeks, and we had to live with her bad temper and complaints. "I'm not the kind of person to sit around doing nothing," she said to Doña Ana, and I wondered how she could think of her housework as nothing when she spent hours doing it. "So how do you like the factory?" Doña Lola asked Mammy as we shucked pigeon peas in her new kitchen. "I started as a thread cutter, and now I'm a sewing machine operator." "Qué bueno!" Doña Lola's son, Tato, ran into the kitchen. "Is there anything to eat?" "Rice and beans in the pot." Tato rattled lids and dropped a spoon on the new cement floor. Doña Lola stood up with a jerk. "Let me serve you." And under her breath, "Men are so useless." Tato looked at me from beneath his long lashes. Doña Lola handed him a tin plate mounted with white rice and red beans. He sat in the corner, spooning it in as if he hadn't eaten in a week. He was a year older than I, skinny, brown as a chocolate bar, his hair orange, his hazel eyes full of mischief and laughter. He was the dirtiest boy I'd ever seen, not because he didn't wash, but because he couldn't stay clean no matter how many times Doña Lola dunked him in the tin tub in the back of the house. Tato was not afraid of anything. He caught bright green lizards, pinched their jaws at the side, and forced them to bite his earlobes, to which they clung like festive, squirming decorations. He trapped snakes and draped them around his neck, where they writhed in sumptuous, silvery waves that seemed to tickle. He speared iguanas and roasted them on open fires, claiming that their meat was tastier than chicken. He was an expert slingshot maker, and it was he who taught me to choose the forked branches that we stripped of bark, dried in the sun, and carved until we could tie split inner tube strips and a rubber square that held the lethal stones we shot with uncanny accuracy. I was as good as he with both slingshots and painstakingly constructed bows and arrows, with which I could drop birds in flight. We had an uneasy, competitive friendship, made more special by the fact that Mammy didn't approve. "You're almost señorita. You shouldn't be running wild with boys," she'd tell me. But I didn't have anything in common with the girls my age. Juanita Marin had found more kindred friendships at her end of the barrio, and Doña Sena's daughters, who were about my age, were kept on a tight leash because of their parents' religiosity, which didn't allow for outside influences. My sisters close to my age were not as interesting as the neighborhood boys who ran and climbed and didn't mind getting dirty. Tato put his dish and spoon in the dishwater. "Let's go play outside." His small, dirty face betrayed no hint of what we were really going to do. "Can I, Mommy?" She cracked the tip off a pot, pulled the string, snapped the casing open, slid her thumb inside the slithery shell, and added the peas to the mound in the bowl between her knees. She looked at me with a warning. "Don't go too far. We're going home soon." I thought maybe she had read our minds, and for a minute I was afraid to go with him. "Come on," Tato called from the yard. I backed out of the kitchen, but Mammy and Doña Lola had gone back to their shucking. We ran around the yard a couple of times to throw them off, then sneaked into the oregano bushes that grew thick and fragrant behind the outhouse. "You first," he said. "No way, you first." He pulled down his shorts and just as quickly pulled them up. "Your turn," he said. "I didn't see anything." "Yes, you did." "I didn't, and I'm not going to show you mine until I do." Although I'd seen both Hector's and Raymond's penises when I changed their diapers, I'd never seen one outside the family. Tato had no sisters, so I was pretty sure he'd never seen a girl's private parts. I, of course, had seen several of those, too. "Well, I'm not pulling my pants down again," Tato said, walking away. "Fine. I don't have to see your silly old little chicken. I've seen my brothers, and I bet they're nicer than yours." "Those are baby pollitos. I'm already big. Mine has hair on it." "Oh, sure. It does, and it gets so big, it can already go into a woman. You're disgusting." "I can get it into a woman and wiggle it around and around like this." He wiggled his finger in arches that circumscribed a space much larger than his hand, at the same time wiggling his hips in figure eight. "You're sick." I ran into Doña Lola's yard just as Mommy came out. "I was coming to find you," she said, looking behind me. Tato watched us from the path into the bushes. "Grab that bag. We're going home." Doña Lola handed me a sack full of pigeon peas. "Tato, go and feed those pigs. They've been squealing all afternoon." He ran off, and Mommy led the way up the road to our house. "What were you two doing in back of the outhouse?" she asked casually. "Just playing." I hoped she hadn't heard us talking. She didn't say any more, and I took the shortcut home, through the yucca plants, past the barren mango tree at the edge of Lalao's finca. Another day, Tato and I were behind the latrine. "I can see it better if you squat," Tato said, crouching in front of me to get a better look at the smooth slit between my legs. "Forget it," I pulled up my panties. "But it's not fair. You saw mine real good. See? And you lied. There's no hair on it at all. You didn't look close enough. There was nothing to see. It's just as shriveled and small as my baby brother's. You have to rub it to make it big. No way am I touching your dirty little pollito. It'll grow big and long, you'll see. No way. I'll touch you if you touch me. I don't want you to touch me. It feels good." He rubbed his crotch as if he had an itch. He thrust his hips out toward me. "Ooh, it's so good. Mmm." He closed his eyes and smacked his lips like he was eating the sweetest candy. I stared at him, writhing, his tongue flicking in and out of his mouth, foamy spit at the corners, his eyes rolling in his head, his hands moving faster and faster. "Men are such pigs." The words flashed into my head like the headline on a newspaper, only I heard it too, in the voices of Mami and Doña Lola, Gloria and Doña Ana, Abuela, bolero singers, radio soap opera actresses, and my own shrill scream into Tato's face. "Cochino! Pig!" His eyes popped open, and his mouth dropped into a grimace that became a lewd, ugly, humiliating smile. He tried to grab between my legs, and, enraged, I drew back my foot and kicked as hard as I could so that it seemed that I lifted him on my shin before he crumpled to the ground, hands between his legs, no longer rubbing but holding fast to what I was afraid had come loose. Mami and Doña Lola came running. Between sobs, Tato told them I had kicked him for no reason at all, and Mami dragged me home, her fingers pinching my bony arm. I screamed, trying to explain what Tato had tried to do, but Mami wouldn't listen. I pulled loose and ran, and she chased me into our yard and through the house. On the way out the kitchen door, she grabbed a frying pan and thwacked my head. She tied my wrists together in one of her strong hands and beat me again and again, raising welts on my arms, my back, the back of my head, my forehead, behind my ear. My sisters and brothers came out from wherever they'd been playing, even Raymond, who had just learned to walk, and they watched as Mami lifted the pan over her head and let it fall on the ball I had become, hanging from her hand like an unripe fruit on an unbending tree. "Don't you ever, ever do that again," she growled, and I wasn't sure if she meant kicking a boy between his legs or letting him see my private parts, because it seemed to me she knew what Tato and I did behind the latrine while she and Doña Lola talked about their lives. She knew, and she was waiting for me to do something worse than what I could imagine so that she could do something far worse than what I would expect. I let my body go limp to take her abuse, and part of me left my body and stood beside my sisters and brothers, their eyes round, tear-filled, frightened, their fingers interlaced into each other's, their skinny bodies jerking with every hit I took. Gloria came back to live in a neat wood house in the middle of a coconut grove behind her mother's property. Her marido was from a nearby barrio and worked for the electric company. Maybe now, Mami joked, we'll get light back in Macung. As soon as Gloria returned, Mami unfolded her work clothes, washed her hair, and polished her shoes. But instead of Gloria coming to our house every morning, we now went to her shady house under the palms. One day, she handed me a small paper bag, tightly packed with something soft. Throw this into the latrine, would you please? What is it? Nothing that concerns you. Then why should I throw it out? Are you this mouthy all the time or just with me? All the time. I figured. Take the thing out and I'll tell you about it when you come back. I was tempted to open the bag and look inside, but she kept her eye on me as she changed Raymond's diaper. When I looked down the hole of the latrine, I noticed a couple of little bags like the one I held floating on the dark, smelly waste at the bottom. Okay, I threw it out. She put Raymond and Edna down for their afternoon siesta. The air was light, breezy, aromatic of guavas, which grew in tall bushes along the side of our house. What was inside the bag? A Kotex. What's that? She poured water into a bowl and salted it generously. How old are you? 10. She grabbed 2 green plantains from a high shelf and brought them to the table. And Doña Monin hasn't told you about being a señorita? She told me I should stop playing with boys because I'm almost señorita and that I should keep my legs closed when I sit. Gloria laughed so hard she almost dropped the knife she found near the fogón. What's so funny? I was embarrassed and pleased. Clearly, there was a lot more to this señorita business, and Gloria knew what it was. I laughed with her, sensing she was about to tell me something my mother was supposed to, but hadn't. Do you know where babies come from? Everybody knows that. Do you know how they're made? I'd seen roosters chase hens, catch up, climb on top of them, and dig sharp beaks into the hen's head as she cackled and screeched and he flapped his wings. I'd seen male dogs chase females, the male climb on top of the female, ride her while she tried to shake him off and dig his narrow pink penis into her backside. I'd seen bulls ride cows, horses hump mares, pigs rolling in mud, their bodies connected under the female's tail. And I'd seen eggs laid, bloody puppies wet and shimmery, calves encased in a blue bubble, slippery, wet ponies, thin and vulnerable, and hundreds of pink piglets suckling engorged teats. But until Gloria asked, I'd never put it together that in order for me and my 4 sisters and 2 brothers to be born, Papi had to do to Mami what roosters did to hens, bulls did to cows, horses did to mares. I shuddered. Yes, I know how babies are made. Gloria slid a plantain from tip to tip, peeled the casing back, and cut diagonal slices which she dipped in the salted water. Before you can make babies, you have to be a señorita, which means you bleed once a month. Gloria then explained what a period was, how long it lasted, what a woman had to do so her clothes wouldn't get soiled. Very soon you will be a señorita, she said, and then you have to keep your legs crossed, just like your mommy says, all the time. She laughed at her own joke, which didn't seem so funny to me. Ay, you're so solemn. I must have scared you. Don't worry, it's nothing, just a nuisance you learn to live with. Every woman does. But I wasn't worried about my period, which couldn't possibly be worse than the worms I'd found in my panties. I imagined Mami and Papi in bed, stuck together in the middle. I remembered Tato's words that he could stick his penis in a woman, and I realized that's what Papi did to Mami after we'd all gone to sleep and the springs on their bed creaked in rhythms that always ended in a long, low moan like a moo or a hoarse whimper. Mami was one of the first mothers in Macung to have a job outside the house. For extra money, women in the barrio took in laundry or ironing or cooked for men with no wives. But Mami left our house every morning, primped and perfumed, for a job in a factory in Tua Baja. The barrio looked at us with new eyes. Gone was the bland acceptance of people minding their own business, replaced by a visible, angry resentment that became gossip and taunts and name-calling in the schoolyard. I got the message that my mother was breaking a taboo I'd never heard about. The women in the neighborhood turned their backs on her when they saw her coming, or when they talked to her, they scanned the horizon as if looking at her would infect them with whatever had made her go out and get a job. Only a few of the neighbors stood by Mommy. Doña Ana, whose daughter watched us, Doña Sena, whose Christian beliefs didn't allow for envy, and Doña Lola, who valued everyone equally. Even Tio Candido's wife, Mary, made us feel as if Mami was a bad woman for leaving us alone.